Hello, I'm Rob Hirschfeld, CEO and co-founder of RackN and your host for the Cloud 2030 podcast. In this episode, we continue to dive into a topic that is related to edge technology, although our discussion was pretty general, about IT versus OT, or information technology versus operations technology, and this ongoing dilemma of edge sites specifically, but that includes factories, retail locations. I think this is actually inclusive even in data center technology and standard cloud, of having operational tech, which is vendor locked, narrowly controlled, siloed technologies versus general purpose technology. So in this case, we're talking about OT as specific vendor locked islands of technology versus IT, which is really multi-purpose, multi-function, shared infrastructure technologies. And we really get into the tension and how to resolve the tension between those two technology approaches. I know you're going to enjoy the podcast. Have a good time.
This actually, if you'll take the transition, this would be a good place to actually jump into the IT-OT edge conversation in a way.
Exactly.
Sure.
Because one of the things to me that is, you know, a struggle for, and this actually is edge, but I think it's actually IT versus OT even more, is this idea of general purpose infrastructure versus specific purpose infrastructure. Like the we have the same issue. If you look at building out an edge site, if you're building, right, if you have components and systems that are vendor specific, then, you know, you lose that vendor, you're done. But if you can move some of it or all of it into general purpose hardware, general purpose operating systems and things like that, it seems like a better maintenance story along the same lines as what you're talking about.
Maintenance and all along a bunch of other stuff. I was talking to a friend in the Air Force yesterday prepping for this, and we were talking about the F-35 is a flying Mach 2 data center that is stuffed to the gills. And another guy I've been working with, he's a math PhD, and he built this whole automated system for stitching together communication systems. So think about 5-4 project, you know, F-35s communicating with F-22s, communicating with, you know, other weapons platforms, and they all speak different languages. It's that Tower of Babel problem. And what he had developed in the Stitches program was basically it would pull the messaging format and automatically write code to be able to convert F-35 speak to F-22 speak so that fighter pilots could not only talk to each other, but you could talk to F-22 pilots in the Royal Air Force and in France and et cetera and so forth. So language conversion and all of this. But the way that it was required is it has to deploy to a microservice on a container.
Yeah.
Well, okay. So now it's like, okay, well, now we need a K8 cluster sitting on an F-35 at 40,000 feet. Okay. But the F-35 has every single square millimeter accounted for in the airframe, which means that what we'd have to do is modernize some of the existing software systems within that platform so that we could free up space for general purpose computing to be able to accommodate this additional need. And so in the IT-OT use case, what I'm saying here is that there's a future backwards compatibility advantage to be had by being able to have some component of legacy OT systems that includes a general purpose component.
Mm-hmm.
So
does this always have to be done in situ, like on the aircraft?
No, it's a whole software supply chain lockdown issue. So they have to, you know, go through the whole process and create, you know, standard K8 deployment model, but it's got to be hardened and tested before it gets pushed up to the K8 cluster.
Okay.
So you'd be very interested in two levels of protocols and IT/OT integration from a bunch of companies that are working in the robotic space that are addressing it for manufacturing. And there is a protocol called Zeno, Z-E-N-O-H. And the two companies, one is called Move AI and the other is called Zettascale. And they're coming at it from the perspective, not of aerospace and defense, but automotive, where you have exactly the same problem, just a different domain, where you're trying to do V to X communication, and they're actually doing ETL in flight. So they've developed not only CUDA, but also Kubernetes and other microservice containers to be able to do this. So they're taking in everything literally from the microcontroller to the cloud, mm-hmm. or the cloud to the microcontroller. So it has use in aerospace and defense, industrial manufacturing, V to X, anything to anything. And they have, in one case, one of these companies has done a provisioning plugin to be able to do the bare metal kind of stuff that Rob is doing. And that would be a very interesting thing for you, Rob, to take a look at. I've been doing a lot of research on this stuff for like the last 6 months in terms of how are you going to take the walled garden of robotics, think Spot, Boston Dynamics, or Atlas, or any of those, and integrate them with something from Siemens, which will never speak the same language because right. they've created their own walled garden. And each of the subsystems that you're referring to in aerospace has exactly the same issue, mm-hmm. not only about compatibility, but fighter jet to fighter jet across different disciplines and domains, meaning it's Canadian, it's American, it's UK, it's Australian, whatever their, you know, NATO country, you have a big issue.
Robotics to you know, small drones and
right.
those are exactly same issues.
Yeah.
That's where I have this vision of like bringing together these different integration technologies at different layers of the OSI stack and between IT and OT. So that's what got me interested in Stitches, is because it's doing what I'm doing it at the data layer, and he's doing it at the RF comm layer and the messaging network comm layer. And then coincidentally, Rob's doing it at the infrastructure cloud layer. And if you were able to pull that all together, you could have this whole industry 4.0 optimized ability to move entire everything from cloud to cloud, you know, to different IT and OT platforms. So basically,
sure.
Yeah.
So go take a look at the open source Eclipse project on Zeno, because I can tell you that they have done, I believe that they're building a platform like an industry 4 operating system would be the best way to describe it. So they have many, many capabilities, not only in the Zeno language, but they can do things like DDS to OPC UA or DDS to MQTT or any of the broker type things with various brokers, various plugins, and break the notion of the walled garden. And in Move's case, they came at it from a fleet management perspective for factories, right? You have different types of AMRs running around and different types of AVGs and other equipment, so that why do you have to go and do a full IIoT implementation with sensors and actuators and then work in the robotic side when the robots can pick up all of the data from the machines directly? Like that takes years off of deploying.
That's the thing that's always been strange to me, is that why is it so hard for us to have move these systems into using more standard delivery or standard packaging, right? Or standard protocols from that. I mean, I did a stint in a physical security company where we had been making our own hardware. And one of the things we tried to architect was switching it to standardized servers, like buying a COTS server instead of building our own machine, which would have been much more powerful, have a lot more capability. But it interestingly was much more expensive. Like we couldn't get the cost to work out for using standardized hardware. But we also weren't in a position, and this is a chicken the egg issue, to say, hey, we just need to put a VM or a container in your infrastructure, and then and then we don't need hardware at all. We're just going to use, we're going to sell you the locks or the software. But that was that was 15 years ago, but it was a really hard conversation, or it was an impossible conversation. There was no way for us to do that.
Yeah, the economics would be different now. This reminds me of, so, you know, back in the day when I was a chipset engineer at HP doing Superdomes, the folks, engineers I worked with went and left and joined a startup called Convey Computers. And what they were doing is reconfigurable processor architectures on CPLDs for special purpose workloads. And this was 15 years ago as well. And that never worked out because they only found traction with very specialized scientific workloads like upstream oil and gas data munging type stuff, right?
Quick question, Tyler. When you were speaking a little bit before, were you talking about actual migration? Are we talking about container migration, or are we talking just kind of general purpose, communications?
I gotcha. I conflated a couple of things there.
Okay.
I was talking about the software supply chain delivery of container images for deployment. But then once that's there on the general purpose compute, is this, universal translator to speak F22 and F35. So two separate things. I apologize for that.
Just wanted to be clear. Make sure I got it right. Thanks.
But what I was saying about Convey and the special purpose reconfigurable processor architecture stuff is it was the same thing you were talking about, Rob, is that scale out computing, Moore's law economics completely trashed that business model. And I think we're going to see the same. I mean, Moore's law continues.
But there's a different side of it, and we still see this as a problem, is that the IT ability to provide a consistent, reliable service also makes the OT delivery much harder from that perspective. So I'll give you the old example, but I still see this playing out over and over again, is that when we were running locks for people. And so if somebody said, oh, don't worry about your server, we'll put up a VM, we'll make it work. All you have to do, we'll run your software for you. We're going to get the call when people are locked out of their building, right? OT systems are usually operationally critical. The OT provider gets the call when the IT infrastructure is failing. And I think one of the problems that we've had in this whole idea, and maybe the fighter jet's a good example, right? I mean, I get a little bit nervous, right? My stomach tightens up when I think of a fighter jet running a Kubernetes cluster. IT does not have the reputation and the practice to have those mission critical systems running.
Yes, but another way, what you're saying is that, in IT, we think four or five nines is fantastic. But if it's a fighter jet, we need six nines. But in my view, that's just another example of what we need. It's an economics problem because it's a trade-off for resilience. We can deploy multiple K8 clusters on hardware isolated systems, and then use a load balancing or scale out model to be able to create to get to six figures or six nines. The problem is the expense involved in that, and whether that at what point that makes sense economically.
But hold on a second, because I want to challenge something. In the IT model, the general infrastructure model is fundamentally a shared infrastructure model. And the OT model is fundamentally a dedicated infrastructure model.
Go ahead. Sorry for cutting you off.
That's okay.
Apologize.
Okay.
However, if you take a look at what's been happening, and the reason I came at this from the AMR and robotics side is because that no longer holds true. They have to be highly distributed or federated architectural models because they have to be able to do real-time transmission and in-flight and in-transit ETL. So you're talking on a microcontroller, on a computer, on an edge server, let's say, all the way up to the cloud, where you have data center to microcontroller, you have all the different permutations and combinations, and the fact that it's in-flight transmission, because remember, this is being designed for vehicle to anything or anyone or anywhere, that changes.
Does that address Rob's point about dedicated infrastructure?
Yes, because they can distribute it once to all.
How do you overcome the issue of, you know, one system has a vulnerability or a goes off the rails or falls over and then takes down, you know, adjacent systems, which is an IT reality. Part of what we build is, and there's a lot of overhead for it, is that type of thing. Economically, it makes a ton of sense. But if you're an OT person and you're like, oh, my system is now going to fall down because, you know, the cash registers for the robots, the conveyor belt system is antiquated and it has a glitch, you know, so all of a sudden the robots are unable to process because somebody did a patch to the conveyor belt system. I've been struggling to communicate why I feel like there's so much resistance to IT being involved. And I do think that's part of the challenge.
No question. On OT, IT convergence or integration, it is the, you know, it's like men live on Mars and women live on Venus. That kind of it's a religious holy war.
Yeah, it's not a technical problem. It's a people issue.
Yeah, that's one part of it. And the other part of it on the technical side, to Rob's point, what I became very enamored with these systems that are being developed and even out in open source and whatever, and even what Zettascale is working on, is they're using the same concept of what Tumbleweed was. So dynamic routing and dynamic rerouting, so that if part of something fails, it has an alternative to not bring the entire thing down.
Yeah, I mean, that's TCP/IP, right? DARPANET.
Yeah.
Nuclear war resilience.
Right. Level. Yeah. So the way that they've gone about doing it, and I questioned him several times when I was watching it unfold, was where are the flags to an incomplete packet, for example? How does the flag get raised for that? If you're doing ETL in transit and you drop a character off the packet, what then? Like, where are all these contingencies, to your point? But I will send you some data, or aside from the website, of what they've been working on and how it's how they're overcoming some of this. But the dynamics of the way this could work are really intriguing. I'm not sure that I've answered your question, Rob, or that you don't still have a giant red flag. I just need to know more.
I think that, you know, what I'm scratching my head at as I look at, you know, how do we help IT succeed at the edge or in the factory, right? We're talking two different languages. And I don't think IT does a very good job saying we will have ways to get you faster turnaround when you have a patch, you know, better isolation, higher SLAs, better monitoring, there's a lot of stuff you have to overcome to move somebody off of an island into another system. And then I think on the other side, the OT people, this goes all the way back to your stove comment, are sort of like, you know, we have, you know, specialized stuff. It's very proprietary. We don't want to move into, very little incentive to move into using standard equipment or standard protocols. In some cases, because it adds cost. In some cases, because they lose control. Or they lose price protection.
Does all of this, is all of this predicated on building out a net new underpinning, net new infrastructure? Because if you have to consider fitting edge components to an existing network architecture and, you know, kind of backfilling, I realize you're trying to put in place the, you know, talk to anything, let anybody talk to anybody, but that kind of interworking, that kind of interoperation, if you have older infrastructure and you're trying to fit, I mean, I don't know what the implications there are for all of your, you know, your big metrics, you know, reliability, latency, not to mention any issues that it puts on you for scalability.
The thing that's weird to me is that the OT systems at, you know, to Joanne's point, are all converging on COTS stuff.
Which is the right thing to do. I get it.
Correct. But they're doing it in a way that still is not right. They're still not talking the right language to actually say, oh, wait, I don't have to buy a server. I can run the edge infrastructure. You know, the IT team can give me, you know, capacity to do that here.
This has been going on longer than most people realize. You know, I mean, PLCs running ancient versions of Linux. Back in the day, the F22 was running a bastardized version of Windows 95. They didn't broadcast that too much. But and then next generation. I'm sorry, I've got my Air Force hat on right now because that's what I'm focused on. But next generation air dominance platform. So the platform that they're developing after F-35. Is all COTS stuff. It's all, you know, containerized standard IT type stuff. They're just figuring out how to harden it using like custom rad hardened versions of processors all the way up to everything else. So it's out there, but, and that's why my opinion is that this is purely an economic and a cultural issue and not a technical issue.
Well, part of my thought process is also, as I'm watching this stuff unfold and the convergence is happening, and to Rob's point about OTIT convergence, there are a lot of companies that have decided to just virtualize the plant floor. And part of the reason that they're doing that is because they want to build digital twins a lot faster, and this is the only way to do it. So there's that aspect. But what's going to drive this whole thing is you now have some very big kahunas in the fray that are betting the bank on making this stuff work. All of automotive is geared towards this because of vehicle to anything. All of manufacturing is gearing toward it because they want the operational efficiencies of digital twins, and they want to be able to put digital twins together because you can't run an end-to-end digital twin. It's just physically impossible to do, whether it's because of comms and latency and stuff like that, that you just cannot take a 50-year-old piece of equipment and virtualize it because it has nothing to attach to, even with intelligent actuators and sensors. Well, just
this is kind of what I was,
aside.
This was one of the issues that I wanted, to raise. Okay.
Right. So they're looking at, you know, they're trying to do it from the protocol side, and they've been very successful at doing it from the protocol side with zero latency. Because NVIDIA X, which is the next big hurrah and horizon, is you cannot have any kind of latency. Think about what SWIM was doing, right, with traffic. And now with all of the automation in the vehicle, for autonomous vehicle, whether it's level 3 or level 4, it doesn't matter. The point is they all have to talk to each other. They all have to be able to pick up data from each other in traffic, and also from light stanchions, from phones, from pedestrians, from signage, from you name it, they have to be able to glean data from it. That has zero latency.
Well, they're going to have to build in something like a caching model, like what we see in server architectures or content distribution, or and that's going to require some enhancements to the protocol to be able to handle that type of an architecture.
Right.
Well, so what I mean,
without that kind of caching, you know, you're dead. You're dead. Going to be dead in the water. It's not going to. It's not
good. Yeah. There's no such thing as zero latency.
Doesn't
I guess part of what I was,
that's a whole other discussion, because
speed of light,
no, that gets to light, the chips.
Einstein speed of light, no such thing as zero latency. Relativistic.
No, but that would take my brain into FPGAs and chips and, you know, the whole nine yards of that, and I don't think that there's no time for that.
I have a small but interesting aside.
Go ahead.
We'll derail us for a moment, but the White House has issued a mandate to define lunar standard time. Did y'all see this? Because time travels faster on the moon, and there's actually a time drift of the length of seconds, microseconds drift. But
is it really microseconds and not?
Yeah.
Wow.
Like 23 microseconds a year, yeah. I think.
Okay.
Yeah, it's...
Which is material.
Absolutely.
But I thought it was... speaking of Einstein and relativity, I couldn't help but interject the... if you wanted evidence that Einstein was right.
Yeah, that
you
makes...
got it.
That makes sense, because you have the relative velocity differences between the moon and the Earth, and the fact that the light travels faster in a vacuum.
Correct. Yeah, no, just the moon's traveling faster than we are through space. I thought it was fascinating.
Okay, so did they also publish the topic of the day. But did they also publish the current speed of the rotation of the Earth?
I assume they have to factor all that in.
Okay. No, I'm curious before I start Googling things and doing Delta kind of math in my spare brain. I figured maybe they put that
there. I guess if you went deep enough into the core of the Earth,
if you want to totally blow your mind, think about how you'd need to calculate that time drift difference based on the latitude of location on Earth and the latitude of location on the moon.
I suspect that our actual solar orbit has a bigger delta than our rotational orbit, especially because you're going to make up that time as you go around. So I think the net for that's going to probably be zero, whereas your actual solar orbit is probably a bigger contributor. But then again, the moon's got our solar orbit plus its own orbit as from a persistent velocity. So I don't know.
The solar orbit and the
moon mind blowing.
Yeah, the solar orbit should cancel on both sides of the equation for just the Earth and Moon.
So the moral of this story then, the moral of this story then is, well, some of us, I think it's going to miss where I am. I'm going to have to go somewhere else. But the moral of the story is, when you're watching the eclipse, don't blink.
I was waiting until the last minute, because my plan was to get in the car and go see this thing. We saw it in 2017. It was amazing. But the cloud cover is not doing so hot.
It does not look promising. I know.
It does not. No. Maybe in Northeast Missouri, maybe.
But going at the last minute to see it is not advised. Traffic is supposed to be snarled everywhere near totality.
Yeah, I think we're going to pass.
We had events planned for Rack End, and I'm flying people into Austin for our well-planned all-hands meeting, and I just canceled all of Monday activities
because didn't
count on travel.
Yeah.
So. All right, back
side. Oh, before we go back, I've got a quick story I want to tell you guys that I think you might enjoy, because we were talking about the chipset days. So this goes directly how you design for resilience and achieving more nines. So we were having multi-bit errors on the Superdome memory subsystem and couldn't figure out what was going on. For months. And then we realized it was just a specific manufacturer of memory chips. And, you know, with the high end, you know, Unix grade systems, you have custom contracts with memory chip suppliers to provide that. And so we theorized that, well, they did something in the layout of the memory chip on the integrated, the memory circuit on the integrated, you know, chip. And so the way that we were able to validate that was, in the lab, we had all of these Superdomes sitting here side by side, right? And so half of them we went to the home improvement store and got kiddie pools.
Oh my God.
And then put the kiddie pools on top of the servers and then filled the kiddie pools with water. So we were able to prove via that method that it was in fact cosmic ray strikes that were causing the multi-bit errors, because the memory manufacturer had changed their layout so that a proton hitting the chip could actually take out multiple memory cells.
Did you float any rubber ducks in there? That's what I want to know.
Oh, should have.
Well, but done.
That was right. That was some crazy shit.
That's hilarious.
I think my brain just exploded. There's memory cells leaking all over my desk.
The value of understanding physics plays out in the real world.
Oh yeah. Another story. When I was at TRW, we had an ASIC motor controller, and the ADC kept getting strange errors in terms of accuracy, resolution. And I debugged that using Excel by taking all the readings and then processing in an Excel and figuring out which RC circuit in the ADC was actually had the wrong Q constant and wasn't settling in time for the next reading. But it was hard to figure. I mean, we had no ability to probe inside the chip. So you just had to look at the data and figure out what the problem was from the data.
Wow.
So along those lines, I'll pull us back to the question I had for ITOT.
Yeah.
Is some of this just improving ability to patch and respond? Like, because, you know, and we didn't, on Tuesday, we talked about the latest hack attempt. We didn't do it here, which maybe we should plan next Thursday to bring that up, because there's some community lessons in that. But this whole ability of, and I think mismatch for IT and OT, of how you have to be much more able to patch and test, the whole resilience for both of those systems, I think, is really behind where it needs to be. And we're just protecting ourselves by not collaborating at this point. And, you know, is the first foundation just to be able to build systems that you can flow patches through more effectively? Could it be that simple?
I think the answer to that question is the more automatic you can make it, the more hands-off you can make it, the more you would attract the convergence. Because right now, if you think about a test engineer running around a shop floor, trying to not necessarily do the patches even in a one-offs kind of thing, they'll never get it right to begin with, because chances are likely that the firmware has issues. So that's where I think if I've said this to you before, and I don't mean to be repetitive, but if IAC had a home, it would be in manufacturing, because the more you can take that weight off of the OT and break those walled gardens down, the more easily you're going to have the rest of the OT related work start to converge more easily with IT. And I will tell you that with whether it's AMRs or drones or any of the newer technologies, there is a huge gap in that market for being able to rapidly deploy patches, fixes, mm-hmm. new iterations, or even basic firmware across them. And it's needed desperately, because right now you have the biggest kahuna in the world, NVIDIA, getting in this game in a way that's going to change everything very, very quickly. And they're partnering with SAP and Siemens to do it, which means that you have the one end of the whole transactional stack and, you know, shop floor operating systems and whatever. And then you have all of the digitized digital twins, digital threads, tapestries, whatever you want to call them, all converging at once and all wanting to use AI at the same time.
And needing to ramp their throughput.
Absolutely 100%. Yeah.
It's all about process optimization. And what I mean by that is eliminating friction within systems of systems. Kind of goes back to my blog post on data friction. That's the trick.
One of the frustrations for me, though, is that, you know, most organizations aren't prepared to lead you. I keep thinking about, like, Tesla sending patches out and software updates to cars, you know, frequently, and they do it very aggressively. They're known for it. But other manufacturers aren't ready for it. The people haven't been trained for it, right? It's an opportunity for IT to be leading in how well they can distribute, roll out, update patches. But when we're talking about people in IT, they're not leading here. They're not moving into a stance that says, you know, I can patch my systems and in an hour I have a way to roll out. I know how those controls would work.
And they're not, by the way, my prediction is they're not going to, because there's a fundamental business model where interoperability is against the self-interest of vendors.
I agree. I strongly agree with that. And it's until the customers, it is until the customers demand it. The customers need to be making that a buying criteria. And I think, you know, things like the VMware debacle at the moment, as people starting to realize the lack of abstractions is actually very expensive. Not building, not insisting on vendor neutrality is really expensive.
But I think that's, you know, I 100% agree with you, but I think there's another part to it. CIOs are not trained on OT, generally speaking. No matter how big the organization or what type of manufacturing it is, your CIO was originally looking at, I keep the lights on, I keep the computers going, I make sure the help desk is adequate or above par. And now that I have a seat at the table and I have the power to influence, OT is like, oh, how do I do this now? So I'm going to start with security because that's most germane and integral to the company, and work my way up from that. So it's going to take some time. But for folks that are coming from the other direction, where you have a CTO who is OT friendly, they are equally inept.
Do you see that on the in the manufacturing side, Joanne? I know on the defense side, you have a CTO that's the OT CTO or the weapon platform CTO, and then you have an IT CTO, and those are completely different programs and offices.
I think aerospace and defense is a very broad sector that has its own rules and regulations that are governed by military. Whereas in manufacturing, that's not related to aerospace and defense, there's one or the other. There's not usually two. Like, I don't know. I know the CIO at Ford, but I don't know of a CTO at Ford, unless they're specifically in manufacturing parts. But like Ford, as an example, is trying to rewrite all of its software because it over outsourced and couldn't make anything talk to anything else. They're a perfect example of virtualization.
I would bet that it's a separate role at that scale of manufacturing. Maybe smaller manufacturers, maybe not so much.
The U.S. is laggard, right? I mean, I could tell you that Mercedes, yes, it might be two roles. And one, but they actually have five or six different CIO and CTO roles within the same level, because they're all focused on very specific parts of the vehicle, like the LiDAR and the visual aspects, right, where you need those analytics happening, or the batteries, right, as they're becoming lithium. So moving from combustion to EV. Mm-hmm. So they have very dedicated teams for those kinds of things. But to the point that Rob, I think, is making, you don't have a lot of IT leadership that's conversant in OT, and similarly the inverse.
We could broaden that and say conversant in the product side of the business in general. So that could be the manufacturing, and as well as a few years ago, we sat down with the CIO of Manhattan Associates, which is an SAP competitor. And he didn't know squat about, I mean, he knew like the high level, you know, marketing level of the product, but he didn't have any interest or deep knowledge or involvement in the technology or the product strategies that the chief product officer had their chief architects and engineers And that was a completely different organization. And I got the feeling that they don't even really talk.
Well, I think that that's changing very rapidly, only for two reasons. One is, you know, take the comment about North America or rest of world outside of Europe being laggard. They're very quickly catching up because they have no choice in order to compete. But the other part of that is that the fluency of cyber physical systems is now coming to the forefront with things like when you want to get AI in manufacturing that's not part of a visual inspection system or something else, and you're looking at using that as an HMI, that's what's going to drive the convergence and things happening more quickly and in leaps and bounds.
But some of it, I think, is also examples where companies are being successful doing it. They're showing the ROI in very dramatic ways. I'm not a huge fan of the person who claims credit for SpaceX, but you know, one of the things that I think is SpaceX is really remarkable for is that they're not building rockets one at a time. And it's similar to what we're talking about, right? The mistake that a lot of OT and IT people make is that they're like, I'm just building this, I'll get it done once, and then I won't do it. That, you know, with CI/CD pipelines, you wouldn't build a project now without building the CI/CD pipeline first. That has been a remarkable turnaround in industry. You know, this idea that, you know, I'm building a rocket company, I'm building a rocket assembly line first, and you know, once I have that, iterating on the rocket becomes easier. And I think the thing that we're missing here is the now we're full circle. IT is good at iterating and OT needs to learn that behavior. But OT is good at keeping things up and IT needs to learn that behavior. But this fast iteration cycle, I think when people see it, it changes the game for what you can get away with. It's like just-in-time inventory. From that perspective,
yeah,
and we're on the edge, maybe, or just versus just in case,
but you do see it at Mercedes, you do see it at European automotive manufacturers, do see it at Bosch. There's a whole pocket of Eastern Europe that's so dedicated to this that it's as fluid as Tesla. Right, with SpaceX, we're going to build the pipelines. We're going to build the capability of doing, you know, mass production. What they didn't figure out, and this is going to be another thing that just kind of is very disruptive, is that by giving people things like Gen AI to work with, that they're now bringing the end user consumer all the way back to the EDA side. By giving them the fluidity of saying to a system, I want my shoes to be this level of cushion, this amount of millimeters drop from the front to the back, the materials to be recycled or vegan, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They can basically build their build to order for a consumer of one. That's the automotive industry right now. That's the apparel industry right now. It's gradually changing industry by industry sectors. So in Tyler's case, for example, it's not going to be long before you have the fluidity of, you know, Northrop Grumman doing one part and Lockheed doing something else and Boeing trying to get its little nose in there and being shut out because of defects. They're all going to be able to do this in one form or another because they're making the point that if they don't, nothing will work. It's like,
I agree with you, Joanne. That's where it's coming. My fear, though, is that the status quo will persist until there's a shooting war, and we start seeing economies in asymmetric warfare, like the $10,000 drone taking out a $10 million tank.
Yeah, but wouldn't you agree that, like, on, I think it's, I'm going to get it wrong, I'm sure, but the B-1 bomber and old equipment that's been around for like 35 or 40 years or even 50 years that they still have in service that they want to upgrade, that they're now scrambling because they can't, they're having to remanufacture the originally designed parts to keep them from the maintenance side. So that's going to force a lot of change and the fluidity of design.
Well, exactly. So where it is now, so like F-35's on their G version, I think, and basically the only thing that A version and G version share is the windscreen and the airframe. But what I'm still seeing is there's always still a single contract holder. It's Lockheed Martin, and they still control the architecture 100%, and they use that control to aggressively lock out the Boeings and the Northrops. And I've seen it go back since we had the new leadership with the new president, and they've regressed, they've gone back the old way, more the traditional acquisition model that they use. I agree with you. I'm hopeful, but that's not where we're at today, that's for sure, at least in the U.S. military.
Well, I think you're going to see a lot change between now and 2026, just because of the not only the technology advancements that are being made, but also out of necessity. And so I'm not sure, Rob, whether the problem of convergence will go away over that period, but there's going to be disruptors that will influence the time that it will take for that convergence to go, you know, for the issues to become a converged or unified sort of system. An operating system for the shop floors, for plants and manufacturers, will be one of those disruptors that comes up before that time period.
Interesting to think about. Yeah, I feel like there's a lot of motivators. There still isn't quite the killer feature or the killer reason for the
security
to come together. Security would be a good one.
Security is the one.
All right.
Yeah, and I think AI is going to be a big driver of the speed of change here.
That is true. You don't have time with AI to build proprietary systems. That's the interesting, maybe the interesting takeaway here is you know, a lot of the stuff we come back to is security or AI innovation. You don't have the time. Those proprietary systems take a lot of time.
So they're hard to update. I just had a thought. So if email was the killer app of the internet, is AI the killer app of Industry 4.0?
No.
What kind of AI are we talking about here?
Right.
Okay.
Too many flavors.
That analogy doesn't work so well, but
too many flavors. But yeah, you're on to something there.
I mean, there's a pushing force, and for the internet, it was email. And for Industry 4.0, it's all of the changes.
To pick up Joanne's point before she does, it's going to be digital twinning from that perspective. Because right. AI use case is actually a digital twin use case.
And let me just throw in a little history here, because I've got the scars to prove it. We tried to standardize on commercial electronic mail services. The big vendors, the AT&Ts, Telenets, MCIs, everybody else gave lip service to the standardization. They sent their people in for standard email protocols and directories, but what they put in place was absolute crap. And it wasn't until I assumed the vice chairmanship of the EMA and went out and went to all of the petroleum associations, electronics associations, air defense, and basically said, you guys have got to put the pressure on these folks because you cannot talk to one another using their commercial email systems. They're still trying to lock you into their services. So basically, I stacked the deck and got, you know, American Petroleum and AEA to come in and to basically put a gun to all of this, the providers' heads, and said, you either put real standards in place for interoperability or interworking, or we're going to somebody who does. You should have seen how quickly they moved. But it took that kind of gun to the head.
Innovation needs a not so gentle push sometimes.
Well, that's well said, Tyler.
Well, Rich, the same thing happened with B2B.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, look at RosettaNet, look at GS1. They did exactly the same thing. I remember distinctly having conversations with Fadi Shahadi over, are you carrying a carrot or are you carrying a stick?
Yeah.
And his answer was, I'm carrying a stick. And my answer was, but I can get farther with honey than you can with vinegar. You know, and eventually they came to be. But I understand 100% of what you're saying, and I agree with it 100%. But what I'm also starting to see, and you can't leave this as just a little chink in the armor to standardization, is that the resurgence of old ways are becoming new again.
Meaning?
Vertical integration. Companies are doing
vertically integrated. Yeah, no, and
much
and
more than they did before.
Well, and that goes back to the whole Clayton Christensen model, yeah, right? You know, over time. Hey guys, I gotta run.
Me too.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
Well, we have
we're
a leading.
We're way over. This was a great conversation. All right, y'all. I'll talk to you next week.
Bye.
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 Wow. There are so much to unpack in this concept of IT versus OT and what pulls one group into the other camp. And I really appreciated how this conversation morphed into that type of thinking. How do we get the benefits and the needs met of each group? Really a core thing to think about. And I'm really excited to see some of the changes going on. And I love the way our group analyzes the cross-cutting concerns that actually can impact people's careers and day-to-day lives and their enterprises and how they deliver technology. If this is interesting to you, and if you're listening all the way to the end of this podcast, it probably is, please feel free to join us at the 2030.cloud. Check out our schedule, be part of the conversations. Let us know what you think. We really do want to hear from you. Thanks. Thank you for listening to the Cloud 2030 podcast. It is sponsored by RackN, where we are really working to build a community of people who are using and thinking about infrastructure differently, because that's what RackN does. We write software that helps put operators back in control of distributed infrastructure, really thinking about how things should be run and building software that makes that possible. If this is interesting to you, please try out the software. We would love to get your opinion and hear how you think this could transform infrastructure more broadly. Or just keep enjoying the podcast and coming to the discussions and, you know, laying out your thoughts and how you see the future unfolding.
it's all part of building a better infrastructure operations community. Thank you.